This is KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Carly Huckles. A mountain lion attack outside Fort Collins earlier this month captured everyone's attention. In the days since, he remained anonymous, until now.
Yeah, it very much turned into just a full-on fight for survival.
We'll hear a conversation with the man that everyone's talking about.
Then, when the military announced it would lift the ban on transgender troops, Army Captain Olivia Stelick decided to transition from male to female. She says she was welcomed wholeheartedly at Fort Carson.
I can't overstate how much this has opened communication with soldiers and with leaders and with people everywhere, folks that I don't think would have talked to me before.
Then, President Trump tweeted that transgender personnel would not be allowed to serve. We'll explore uncertainty over the military's transgender policies.
And later, at the Denver Zoo, nature takes its course, with a little help. Plus, our film critic Howie Mofshevitz reviews an Oscar-nominated movie.
But first, the big story of the week has been the three-day teacher strike in Denver. It could have gone on a little longer, but it ended just around 6 a.m. Thursday in time to avoid a fourth strike day. Our education reporter Stephanie Daniel was covering this, and she joins us now. So what was the biggest issue or sticking point between the teachers' union and the school district?
So the biggest issue was the pay system. The union wanted more money to go to base salary rather than increasing incentive pay. Mm-hmm. One of the issues is that incentives aren't reliable. During the strike, I talked to a teacher who said one year she made an extra $6,000 because of a one-time bonus. Mm-hmm. Now, because there wasn't a predictable salary for these educators, it made it difficult for them to qualify for things like a mortgage. In fact, another teacher told me she just wanted to know how much she was going to get in her paycheck month to month.
Yeah, and that kind of echoes what one of the teachers, Darlene Rivera, that you spoke with, told you.
So I really think it's time for Denver to quit the experiment of pay for incentives and pay for performance, because most of the people that are in education, we already knew we weren't getting the highest paid jobs in the world. And I don't think those incentives work.
Now, the two sides were in discussions all night. They finally came to an agreement just a couple of hours before the school day began. Superintendent Susana Cordova and Union President Henry Roman sat next to each other and signed the tentative agreement, and then they hugged, which was kind of a nice way to end it. So what are the basics of the agreement?
So the tentative agreement adds $23 million for teacher pay, boosts base salaries by an average of 11.7%, and puts an end to bonuses for senior DPS administrators.
Finally, this morning, we got to an agreement. We signed the dotted line, and we're really excited to be able to be at a place where we are investing in our teachers and their base salaries, rewarding our teachers for working in our high priority and high poverty schools. And so, really great day.
Today, we celebrate the victory that Denver educators won for our students. Educators in Denver Public Schools now have a fair, predictable, and transparent salary structure that will serve to retain our experienced educators.
That was Superintendent Susana Cordova and lead negotiator for the union, Robert Gould.
And what happens next?
Well, it still needs to be ratified by members of the teachers' union and approved by the Denver Board of Education.
All right. Well, thanks, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Now to the other big story we've been talking nonstop about.
Yep.
Earlier this month, a Colorado man fought for his life in the foothills outside Fort Collins. With nothing more than rocks and his bare hands, he killed a mountain lion that sprang an ambush attack while he was trail running.
Man.
I really thought it was a joke the first time I heard about it.
Oh, me too. I mean, I think everyone did, but it's real. The story captured attention around the world and quickly embedded itself in local folklore. KUNC's Luke Runyon caught up with the man and has his story.
Travis Kaufman headed out for a run around noon in shorts and a fleece pullover. He skipped the earbuds, instead opting for the sounds of his own footsteps on the trail. About halfway through his run, he stopped to take in the view from the top of a ridge. The 31-year-old, at 5'10" and 150 pounds, started to descend on a narrow, wooded section of trail.
And I just kind of heard some pine needles rustling behind me. And I stopped and turned. It's one of those situations where sometimes I turn, sometimes I don't.
Because it's usually a deer or a squirrel. But this time, he decided to turn around to see what made the noise.
In this case, it was, in fact, a mountain lion. And so I remember seeing that and just having my gut feel the full impact of the situation.
Kaufman put up his arms and screamed in an attempt to scare the cat away.
Unfortunately, it kept running, and then it eventually just lunged at me. And at that point, I was able to get my arms up kind of in front of my face and block its initial like lunge with its claws and mouth.
The cougar started scratching.
Its jaws locked onto my hand and wrist and pretty much stayed there the whole time.
It wrapped itself around Kaufman's body and dug its front claws into his back. He tried to throw it off, but with its mouth clamped around his wrist, the two ended up tumbling more than 20 feet off the trail into a gully.
But during that fall, the cat ended up on its back, and it still had my wrist this whole time in its mouth, and it was kind of thrashing at me with its front and back claws.
Kaufman used one of his legs to pin the animal's hindquarters to the ground and then searched for a way to fight back. He grabbed sticks, but they were rotted and crumbled when he tried to use them against the cat. With his free hand, he found a rock and began hitting it over the head.
You can tell it stunned it, but it started thrashing a little bit more, and its back legs got free at that point and scratched my back of my calves and then some more on my thighs a little bit.
Kaufman regained control and was able to repin the animal's back legs.
I got my right foot onto its neck, and then I was able to get some weight onto its windpipe, and that's what eventually suffocated it, and then at that point, it released my hand.
The whole battle lasted about 10 minutes.
One of the thoughts that I was having was like, well, this would be a pretty crappy way to die. Just up on the side of the mountain, screaming and having like a little, this cat like wrapped around my wrist, and then like eventually another cat comes in and takes me out, and then getting eaten by a bunch of mountain lions. And it's like, that wouldn't be an ideal way to go.
You had that thought in the moment?
I did, yeah. So yeah, it very much turned into just a full-on fight for survival.
After suffocating the cat and covered in scratches and puncture wounds, Kaufman started running again.
I was just kind of looking around and just feeling like I was being watched by cats on all sides, because I really took in my surroundings a little bit more and then realized that the whole west side of the trail was filled with rock overhangs and just kind of prime mountain lion territory.
Shaken from the attack and miles from his truck, he eventually encountered another runner and two hikers. They gave him water and the use of their phone. One of the hikers drove Kaufman to the emergency room, where he got more than 24 stitches on his face, closing the wounds on his cheeks and nose. Once he was safe at the hospital, Kaufman had time to think about the gravity of what just happened.
You know, people presented in certain situations, they would make the same decision. If you come down to it and you're being attacked and you don't really have much recourse besides killing the animal to get yourself out safely.
News of the attack went viral. State wildlife officials temporarily closed the open space where the attack occurred and removed two other juvenile mountain lions from the area to a rehabilitation center. They're possible siblings of the cat Kaufman killed.
For the most part, like during the whole process, I didn't really make that many decisions. It was a lot of just kind of like instinct. And so there weren't a lot of decisions to second guess or like a lot of critical moments that I had to like rethink or go through and reprocess. So for the most part, I don't feel any residual trauma from it. And I don't know, I tend to like to move forward too with things. That's just kind of my personality.
Kaufman's takeaway from this incident is that the foothills might feel like a place just for people, for recreation, but they're wild. He says the decision not to listen to music while running saved his life. He heard the mountain lion coming before he saw it, and that might have given him the edge. Luke Runyon, KUNC, Fort Collins.
In 2016, the U.S. military ended its ban on transgender troops, allowing them to serve openly. The policy was short-lived, with President Donald Trump moving to reinstate the ban a year later. But as KUNC's Michael De Ioanna reports, amid legal challenges, the fate of transgender troops is still unclear.
I'm visiting a small home near Fort Carson in Colorado Springs.
Hi.
Hi, Olivia.
You must be Michael?
I am Michael.
Come on in.
Hi, good to meet you.
Good to meet you, too.
I'm
How
here to
you?
Meet Captain Olivia Stelik.
Would you like some coffee?
I would love
As we sit down Thank to you. Talk,
Black milk, sugar,
I ask what Army life is like.
I love the Army. I grew up knowing I wanted to do this, and that has not changed.
Stelik's career began 10 years ago with the infantry, and as a man. Now she's a physical therapist, and this is her first time talking about being transgender.
I would love to stay. I think that I have a lot to offer to soldiers, and that's really where my heart is.
But policy advanced by the Trump administration would bar most who are transgender from serving, including those who require or have undergone gender transition. There could be exemptions or waivers for troops with a medical history, and others could continue to serve, but they'd have to do so in their birth gender. In Stelik's case, she hopes she's grandfathered in because she came out and transitioned when it was okay to do so.
There is some uncertainty here.
A Defense Department survey estimates that about 1% of active duty military troops, or nearly 9,000, identify as transgender.
I'm announcing today that we're ending the ban on transgender Americans in the United States military.
That's President Obama's Defense Secretary Ash Carter back in 2016.
Effective immediately, transgender Americans may serve openly, and they can no longer be discharged or otherwise separated from the military just for being transgender.
GLBT advocates applauded the move that came 5 years after the military ended its Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy that prevented gay and lesbian troops from serving openly.
It was pretty wild. It was unexpected, and here we are.
Before that moment, she'd resolved to keep her hopes of transitioning private.
Being in the Army was more important. And so rather than get out, it was, I'm going to stick around and, you know, maybe when I retire, I'll transition. But until then, I'm going to take care of soldiers. That's the thing that I do.
So that's kind of living a double life.
It was, I mean, you just, yes, yes. To some extent, it's difficult to just not talk about it. That's the hardest thing.
In 2017, Stelik transitioned.
I left work on a Friday and then I showed up on Monday with a different name and different pronouns and some makeup, right? Because I didn't have long hair at the time. And folks were remarkably gracious and lovely and kind, and it was wonderful.
So I'm thinking timeline again. Mm-hmm. Right as you made your transition, mm-hmm. Donald Trump tweets.
Yes, that happened.
And what did you think at that moment? What was going through your mind?
So I didn't actually know it had happened. My first patient of the morning came in and said, I don't care what anybody says, I want you to be my physical therapist.
That tweet said, the United States government will not accept or allow transgender individuals to serve in any capacity in the U.S. military. And in a reversal of prior research that showed transgender troops pose minimal impact on military readiness and healthcare costs, the president called transgender troops a tremendous medical cost burden and disruption.
So it's a group of people that statistically have shown that they're more predisposed to suicide and severe anxiety.
Former Army Lieutenant General Thomas Spohr is director of the conservative-leaning Heritage Foundation's Center for National Defense in Washington, D.C. Along with conservative Christian groups, the foundation cheered the president's actions.
The criteria that I think the Pentagon's endeavoring to apply here is fairly consistent with other situations like this, like severe depressive disorder, bipolar, other medical conditions, which, you know, indicate that military service may put them in greater harm, you know, may subject them to even more anxiety and more risk of having some sort of mental episode.
But for Kaylin McCarthy, a Navy veteran who lives in Fort Collins, the elevated risk of mental health issues is only half the story.
It can be life-threatening.
McCarthy transitioned from female to male after serving in the Navy in the 1990s. From his perspective, it's policies like the Trump administration's ban on transgender troops that opens the door for bullying, rejection, and discrimination. And all of those are mental health risk factors.
Not just how you present and how people see you and feel threatened by you, but it could be life-threatening to mentally for that person.
Tell me more about that. Why would that be life-threatening?
It's life-threatening is because there are people, and even me at some point, you know, I attempted suicide. If you can't present as the person that you are, if you're restricted from that, that is mentally, along with physically, devastating. And some people cannot handle that.
That's something Congressman Jason Crow is actively working on. He's a former Army Ranger representing Colorado's 6th District.
What I'm afraid is that the administration seems to be using the military as a tool to advance its culture wars.
Crow supports bipartisan legislation that would allow transgender troops to serve openly. And he may use his position on the Armed Services Committee to push for hearings on the subject.
The military, besides being the force that has to defend our nation, is also a standard bearer of our values. It reflects our values as the nation. And, you know, it was one of the first institutions to desegregate after World War II. And it always kind of has led the way on those issues.
Back in Colorado Springs, Captain Olivia Stelic is shocked by the suggestion that transgender troops downgrade the overall readiness of the military. She concedes that some accommodations may need to be made, like time for those who transition, but any soldier can have a medical issue, and all must meet fitness criteria to serve.
The same process happens for every soldier before we deploy, right? It's this, do you meet the standards? Can you meet the standards? Can you deploy? And in every unit, some people don't.
And in Stelic's case, the opposite happened. When she saw that a unit was going to deploy to Afghanistan without a physical therapist, she stepped up and asked to be sent.
We're at our best when we can be whole people.
What Stelic feared most about transitioning was the possibility of being rejected. But she says she received an outpouring of support from her peers and commanders. And that's exactly what Defense Secretary Ash Carter envisioned in 2016 when he said transgender troops are part of the finest fighting force the world has ever known.
It's like family. That's I can't overstate how much this has opened communication with soldiers and with leaders and with people everywhere, folks that I don't think would have talked to me before.
So you're more authentic self.
You absolutely. Authentic, I am. Yes.
Authentic self.
Yes.
And you're seeing that that's a benefit to the military.
To me, there's no question.
The future of the ban is mired in legal challenges. For now, transgender troops just keep doing their jobs. Michael DeOanna, KUNC.
Aaron, it's the month of love, Black History Month, the month we first made the podcast last year, and the month that I am so glad to be back in the Colorado Edition co-host chair.
Man, Carly, we are so glad to have you back. You picked a great time to come back with so much happening around the state, but did you have a good time off?
I had a baby, and it was a great time off because he's definitely the cutest little baby I've ever seen in my entire life, and I may be biased.
I have to agree with you. I think it's scientific fact that that's true. Well, stay with us. We have a review of the film Never Look Away to get to.
But before we get to that, love is in the air this month, even at the most unlikely of places like the Denver Zoo. Well, sort of. KUNC's Stacey Nick spoke with one zoo official who helps nature take its course. And as it turns out, it's more than just the birds and the bees.
Holly Coulihan is vice president of animal care at the Denver Zoo. She's also the species survival plan coordinator for lions for the National Association of Zoos and Aquariums. That means she decides which lions should go to which zoos.
We really look at zoo populations. We want to have populations that are sustainable for the long term. We don't frequently pull animals out of the wild anymore. A lot of people think that's where animals come from, but most of the animals you see in zoos were born in zoos. So the genetics and the demographics of those populations become really important. We need to look at their pedigrees and make the best matches for breeding.
And how do you do that? How do you play? I mean, essentially, you're a matchmaker. How do you do that?
We have a couple of computer programs that we use. Every animal gets an entry in a database that has his or her whole life story in there, and then we can put that database into a program that does a lot of projections and modeling. And it's like a, you know, online dating for animals. But we look at different things, obviously, than people do. So first we look at demography. So we're looking at having the right number of animals, in right number of females, right number of males, young animals to old animals. We have a limited number of spaces in zoos, so we don't want to breed too many and then run out of space or not have enough, and zoos have empty exhibits.
Does it... I hate to I can never say that word. You know what I'm saying. But is there kind of elements of that where you have to kind of look at personalities and kind of who works well? Do you feel like you're kind of a matchmaker sometimes?
Yeah, there is another layer of, you know, a lot of what we do, we call it a blending of art and science. And so there's an art layer that goes on top of this of the staff really knowing the animals' personalities and understanding what they're doing and what they're telling us. But then sometimes you do. You just have animals that, like, they just don't connect for whatever reason. It's fairly rare with lions, but every once in a while we do see two animals that just don't get along for whatever reason.
So right now at the Denver Zoo, you have a group of four male lions, all brothers, and you also have three females. Just in the last month, you brought in a new male lion, Tobias, specifically for breeding. How do you handle the introductions?
First, they get to see each other, maybe from across the hall, and then we do what we call a howdy, which is there's generally a fence in between the animals, but they can sniff each other and kind of touch each other. And if that all goes well, then we put everybody together.
So if the introduction goes well, everything's fine. But if it doesn't go well, how do you handle that? How do you handle it if the first date doesn't go well?
Once you put a bunch of 300 or 400 pound lions together, there's not a lot you can do. They sort of run the show after that. If things don't go well, then we'll separate them and we might take a couple of steps back and try again. I might try some different techniques. Sometimes waiting until the females are cycling, then they're a little more receptive to a new male, so we might try that strategy. But it's usually just backing up and kind of taking some baby steps forward again.
After our conversation, a first date for two rare tigers at the London Zoo, which is not a part of the U.S.'s Association of Zoos and Aquariums, had a much more tragic ending. A male Sumatran tiger killed the female during their introduction. While nothing like that has happened at the Denver Zoo, it got me thinking about one recent unsuccessful mating that made the news involving the zoo's beloved polar bears. This fall, they were moved to separate zoos, in part because they weren't successfully mating. There was a pretty big outcry because people didn't want them to split up. But as Holly Coulihan noted during our interview, they weren't actually all that fond of each other.
What we would see here with Leah and Cranberry is during that sort of magical time of the year when she, you know, when her hormones made her want to be with Lee, they got along fantastic. But that only lasted a few weeks, and then she would be done with him and tell us they didn't want to be together again. So I think that is a place where, you know, sometimes we do tend to anthropomorphize, because as humans, you know, we sort of project what we think of as long-term monogamous relationships onto animals.
Coulihan says there are several notable couples at the Denver Zoo, including a pair of gibbons apes, which in some cases mate for life.
It's a less common social structure, but it's definitely one we see with some animals. And when we talk about managing animals across zoos, that is something that we look at. So while it would be very normal for us to switch out male lions every few years with a zoo, it wouldn't be normal to do that to a species where the animals, if they were pair bonded and really got along, then we would be more hesitant to do something like that.
So fear not, romance is not dead at the Denver Zoo. It's just complicated. Happy Valentine's Day. Stacey Nick, KUNC, Denver.
Hush, my darling, don't cry, my darling. The lion sleeps tonight. Hush,
Never Look Away is a new film from Germany just nominated for a Best Foreign Film Oscar. It's also picked up awards at major film festivals around the world. For KUNC film critic Howie Mofshevitz, who teaches film and television at CU Denver, the movie is simply devastatingly good.
The maker of Never Look Away, German director Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck, probably has the longest name of any filmmaker in the world. At 6'9", he's also probably the tallest filmmaker in the world. And his new film is one of the biggest movies to come along in years. The film's no special effects action extravaganza. It's the story of an artist. But the movie takes in how art and life interact, as well as the history of Germany from 1940 to about 1980. In the spirit of the title, the film never looks away from the horrors of the Nazi era. The movie's based loosely on the German artist Gerhard Richter. It begins with Kurt, a boy of maybe 10, with his beloved young aunt who takes him to an exhibit of what the Nazis called decadent art. The arrogant Nazi guide explains what's socially, politically, and racially wrong about the art on the walls, but you can see that neither the boy nor the aunt believe a word of it. Then, within minutes of film time, this lovely young woman is hauled off to a mental hospital, sterilized, and finally murdered. What she left with young Kurt was the warning to never look away, which he never does. And neither does Donnersmarck. Never Look Away has an extraordinary clarity of vision, shaped by the longtime American cinematographer Caleb Deschanel. His sharp images match the crisp characters and events. Karl Zeban, Sebastian Koch, is the arrogant, precise Nazi gynecologist who sends the aunt to her doom. But he's also the kind of creep who passes the real dirty work to others. He's in Kurt's life for years as he glides from Nazism to communism in East Germany, always the pretentious, contemptuous guy who knows how to win and dominate everybody else. Eventually, he makes it to the West, still the self-serving Herr Professor, whose past is either unknown or ignored. As an adult, Kurt, Tom Schilling, reaches the West sooner than Zeban. From communist art school, where he's required to paint dreary, ideologically correct socialist realism, stuff like heroic railroad workers, Kurt and his young wife escape to the utter freedom of a West German art school, with no requirements or demands. It's 1960. The hideous pop song The Surfin' Bird blares from the radio. Hitchcock's Psycho plays at the local theater. Young artists in the grip of conceptual art search for their big ideas. They slash canvases, slap globs of grease and felt on walls, or pound hundreds of nails into a board. Never Look Away sees history as twisted, interlaced connections between people and gestures. Nobody's killed or tortured on screen, but the precise, devastating scenes of bureaucratic Nazi brutality early in the movie reverberate for the rest of the tight-knit 3 hours of the picture. Zeban, the vile gynecologist, is the father of Kurt's beloved, Paula Beer, whose name, Elizabeth, was the aunt's name also. The East German art teacher condemns artists who believe in themselves as individuals. Me, 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 he mocks them. Kurt finally comes to repeat those words, although this time they have to do with discovering in himself what matters. What is it he really wants to paint? And that is the still uncovered remnants of the Nazis. Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck's 45 years old. He was born in East Germany. Never Look Away is just his third feature. The first, the 2006 The Lives of Others, is about the Stasi, the East German secret police, literally peering into the lives of other people, people under suspicion because they're artists. It won an Oscar as Best Foreign Language Film. The history of Germany from the late 30s to the 90s and the threat to tyranny from art seem to be his subjects. You might wonder how there can still be new and magnificent stories of those times. Never Look Away shows how. For KUNC, I'm Howie Mofshevitz.
This has been Colorado Edition, made possible with support from RKUNC members. If you enjoy listening and you're not a member, you can make a gift anytime in any amount you like at KUNC.org. Our show this week was produced by me, Erin O'Toole.
And me, Carly Huckles.
Welcome back.
Thank you. News director Catherine Welch contributed to our show, along with editors Brian Larson and Jackie High, who manages digital.
Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Kalatana.
We also heard Robbie Reverb with Bling Bong. Other music in this episode was provided by Blue Dot Sessions.
If you like what you're hearing, make sure you never miss an episode. The best way to do that? Subscribe at KUNC.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
And don't forget to join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.